You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Digging Up Ancient Aliens. This is the podcast where we examine strange claims about alternative history and ancient aliens in popular media. Do their claims hold water to an archaeologist, or are there better explanations out there? We are now entering episode 57. I am Frederick, your humble guide into the realm of strange claims and pseudoscience. So let's dust off our thinking cap and join in on the exploration of two objects brought up in the Ancient Alien episode Relics from season 6, episode 8. First, we will spend time with four golden hats from the European Bronze Age. Some claim they function as priestly antennas, but how do they fit into the Bronze Age cult? Then we will move on to the Copper Scrolls, one of the maybe more mysterious scrolls within the Dead Sea Scroll collection. It is a real-life treasure map written on copper and hidden in a cave that Indiana Jones or Nick Cage or any other treasure movie franchise has not picked up on this story yet is a little bit strange. Maybe the strangest thing in this whole episode. Well, as always, this episode's sources are available at episode website on diggingupancientaliens.com. There you can also find contact info if you notice any mistakes or have any additional information. And I can't start before thanking all of those who support the show through Patreon or the member portal. Thank you very much for your support. I feel very honored. If you want to enjoy our content early, without ads, and with exciting bonus materials, I have some great news for you. Stick around until the end, and I will share with you exactly how you can access all of that. Now that we have finished our preparation, let's dig into the episode. We rarely discuss European history and archaeology on this show, so I'm more than happy to present some artifacts related to, well, actually the Scandinavian Bronze Age. While the artifacts themselves are not Scandinavian, I will soon get into how these are related to Scandinavia. First of all, what are we even talking about? Great question, and hold on to your hats, because it's actually four golden hats. These cone-shaped hat was hammered into shape from one sheet of gold, or four sheets, and there are four known examples of these hats existing today. And they most likely had some organic material on the inside to make them more comfortable to wear, because it seems as they were actually meant to be worn. Today, three of them are located in Germany, and it's the Eseldorf Busch hat, the Berlin hat, and the hat of Schifferstadt. While the Eseldorf Busch and Schifferstadt's hat have unknown provenance, the origin of the Berlin golden hat is unknown. Scholars believe it's most likely originated in Switzerland. Then we have the fourth example, the Avanton gold cone, found in France in 1844. These cones or hats are 30 to 80 centimeters tall and weigh around a half kilo. And they are richly decorated, and they were created during the European Bronze Age. Interestingly, we see influences from the Nordic countries and also Mediterranean influence from, for example, Sardinia. But before we get a bit ahead of ourselves, we will see what the ancient alien theorists have to say about these hats.
The golden hats are kind of interesting because if gold is something that actually enhances your connection with energies and higher up celestial beings, then the wearing of a golden hat, especially in a conical shape, would tend to amplify the signal that you were getting from on high. So it seems to me that ancient cultures logically would build them, yet connected with the gods who had perhaps left them behind and gone back to their celestial birthplace.
I must tip my hat to Michael Barra, who was at least, he was creating a bit of an exciting narrative here. The hats were antennas to strengthen the signal between the extraterrestrial and their spokespersons on Earth. Well, I find this a little bit amusing, and I mean, it would do for a fun sci-fi or fantasy element. However, they are trying to claim that these ideas that they present in this show are scientifically rooted and come from sound science. So if all it takes is a half a meter antenna to connect with the aliens, why haven't any of our humongous telescopes picked up a single beep, except of course the 1977 WOW signal the Ohio State University Radio Observatory picked up? But while we don't precisely know what the WOW signal was, or even if it was artificial to begin with, it might be one of the few cases where a extraterrestrial solution to this question might be plausible. So I'm sorry, but if our largest telescope, the 500 meter apparatus spherical telescope, and people complain that archaeologists don't have any fantasy regarding names, have not picked up an alien signal, why would a small gold cone be able to do that? The radio telescope I mentioned is 500 meters in diameter and is located in China. There they have a bit more of a fancy name for it, where it's called the Heaven's Eye. So, if these golden cones were not intended to be used as a car antenna, what were they used for? If we look closer at the hats, especially the Berlin Gold Hat, we can see a pattern of what seems to be suns and moons repeated in a very distinct pattern. With this arrangement, we can actually get a solar and lunar cycle stretching over 19 years. From this, you can calculate 228 solar months and 235 lunar months. So if you were a king or a priest who could read this pattern, you could foresee lunar eclipses, you could calculate shifts between seasons, and be able to set fixed events within the year. So we see the same patterns and possibilities within the three other cones that we have preserved. And don't think this as an outlier, though. We see astronomical representation and understanding in other artifacts from the European Bronze Age. Emilia Pastor, for example, describes how sundogs, halos, and round atmospheric phenomena with four spokes are repeatedly represented within the Bronze Age material. This shows that the sun and the moon were significant within the Bronze Age society. Then we have several other artifacts with an astronomical connection, such as the German Nebra Sky Disk, the Danish Trundholm Sun Chariot, the Balåkra Drum from Sweden, and the Kokkino site. Kokkino is an extinct volcano in North Macedonia that served as a Bronze Age observatory. So clearly these cones or hats were connected to the sun cult dominating the European Bronze Age. While the finds seem to be in areas connected to the Urnfield culture, it is not sure if it really fits into this culture. Looking at the hats, we see a connection to Scandinavia. For example, in the Kingsgrave in Kivik in Scania, we have petroglyphs that depict a similar conic hats. We also have a set of figures in Stockholt in Sweden, and these figures have a conic hat with brims that remind one of the golden hats. A similar set of figures has also been found in Denmark. Looking at the Bronze Age petroglyphs in Sweden, it's clear that they have imported elements and gods from the continent. Elements from Cyprus, Minoan, and even Egypt can be found looking at the petroglyphs, especially in southern Sweden, in Scania or in Swedish Skåne. While I do enjoy the image of a Bronze Age priest pulling up the gold cone like an old car antenna, it's just simply fiction. These hats fit pretty well within the culture of the Bronze Age. These hats were used as power symbol, something we still see today. Just look at most religions and royalty. They all have different fancy hats. These seem to have served an additional function as a calendar on top of it. But we don't need any advanced astronomical knowledge to really be able to create these cones or hat. And from the beginning of stratified society, humans have sought a way to make those in power more visible and distinct them from the general population. That's why they always is depicted as larger than other people in paintings, and why they get fancy hats and other regalia. Again, to set them aside from the peasants or other classes within this society. And from European hat fashion, we will venture to the Dead Sea for our next artifact. After the break, we will head over to the Dead Sea, where in the Qumran caves, a special scroll has been found, and from the looks of it, it could be evidence for an enormous hoard of treasure. The Dead Sea Scrolls are a collection of texts that I think most of you are already familiar with. These scrolls were first found by Bedouin shepherds in 1946 in the Qumran Caves. Some 970 manuscripts have been found within 12 different caves. They are written in Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek. But we will focus on one particular manuscript today. And it stands apart from the others for several reasons. One is that it's written on copper.
All the Dead Sea Scrolls that have been found were written on either leather or papyrus. The copper scroll is the only one made of copper. But you got to keep in mind, copper was valuable, and to hammer out a whole scroll would take a lot of time and a lot of technique. So it has to be very important.
An important question to settle before we move forward is when this document was written. Scholars like Ze'ev Safrai puts the date somewhere in the middle of the 1st century CE. This is based on paleography, which is the study of ancient and historical handwriting. This discipline involves analyzing how letters and words were formed in manuscripts, enabling researchers to date and authenticate old text, understand historical context, and decipher writing no longer in use. It can also be used to date a document based on the writing and its content. And when we call it the Copper Scroll, this is quite a literal name on it. The creator has put a lot of effort in making a copper sheet look like the vellum or leather sheets and other documents that was stored in the Qumran caves. The plates were even rolled up when it was first discovered. Two pages were rolled together and a third page was rolled separately, but they were tied together. Rivets were initially holding the one pair of scrolls together, but these seem to have been lost to time. So it was important for the creators that this document looked and was treated like the other documents in the Dead Sea Scroll collection. You might wonder what was written in this scroll, and I will have John DeSalvo from Ancient Aliens sum this up for us.
The Copper Scroll lists 64 locations in Jerusalem and around that area that buried treasure is located. Maybe the key is in the 64th location, it says there's another copper scroll that will help explain the rest of it. Because we haven't found the treasure yet. I somehow suspect there could be another code within this treasure map, a code within a code.
DeSalvo is correct that this document seemed to describe different locations with treasure. A treasure that has not been found even to this day. To some extent, we actually have a real mystery here, but before you grab a shovel and book a trip to Jerusalem, we should put this document in its historical context. I also want to give some examples from recent re-examination of the document by Emil Puech. Puech is suggesting a new reading of the document, and the number of locations is not 64, but 60, based on this new translation. Lefkowitz suggests it would be 60 locations already back in 2000 or 2002, and the translation of the Copper Scroll is tricky because it's written in older Hebrew, while we have ample documents and dictionary that cover old Hebrew. Almost all of them are religious, making the translation of this secular text, like we have in front of us here, a bit more challenging, since not all words used are defined in this context. But let's read the document to really understand its structure and see what it actually can tell us. So we're going to read from the first column, row 1 to 5, as translated by Puech. In the ruin, which is the valley of Achor, under the steps leading to the east, at 40 half-bricks cubit, there is a chest of silver and its vessels, a weight of 17 talents. In the sepulchral monument, in the third layer, 100 gold ingots. In the great cistern, which is in the court of the peristyle, at the side of its floor, seal in the circular wall, opposite the upper opening, 900 talents. In the mound of Kollet, there are tithe vessels, consisting of flask and ephods. The total of the tithe and the store treasury of the sabbatical year, and a second disqualified tithe. Its opening is on the northern edge of the channel, 6 cubits in the direction of the Frigidarium of the Bath. In the spiral staircase of Amenos, in the descent to the left, at a height of 3 cubits from the bottom, silver, 40 talents. Well, it almost sounds like G.R.R. Tolkien when he had his whole section about a dwarf divvying up the treasure in, you know, the Bilbo book. Or just add Nick Cage reading this in a leather jacket and you have basically National Treasure 6 without much more efforts. As we hear, the document really sounds like a real-life treasure map. And it's a little bit beyond me how this has not been turned into a movie yet. At the same time, you might start to wonder why people are not out there in the leather jackets and looking for these vast quantities of gold and silver that the document talks about. Just to list a small part of the treasure, it supposedly contains 165 bars of gold, 19 bars of silver, and 362 gold talents. And during the Second Temple period to which this text most likely dates, one talent is about 34 kilos or 74 pounds, and 1,672 talents of silver. What I counted up here is just a tiny portion of the stuff we have within the scrolls. But if we start to add up everything, it would be, well, let's say a lot of hidden riches. So where are the treasure hunters? People have spent unknown millions of dollars digging up a hole on a small island in Canada. Why don't we see this effort here? Could it be because it's all made up? And there is some discussions about this among scholars. Some argue that there never was a treasure in the first place, while others suggest that the treasure is actually real. And then we have the middle way, of course, which often might be the best route. Now, the Copper Scroll is not the first or only document we have describing a hidden hoard of treasure. Ze'ev Safrai describes another document in an anthology of collected documents called Agadat Bereshit by R. Abraham. In the Tractate Kelim document, we encounter a text strangely similar to what we can read in the Copper Scroll. Safrai has identified four main similarities between these two texts. Quote, 1. Tractate Kelim states the list was written by Shimur the Levite and his colleagues on a copper plate. 2. According to Tractate Kelim, the vessels of the temple made by King Solomon were hidden away, as were gold and silver hoards. The copper scrolls contains a detailed description of hidden gold and silver treasure hoards. 3. Section 10 of Tractate Kelim states that some treasures was hidden in Kakhal Spring. In the copper scroll, Kolit appears in a description of the hiding place of 5 of the treasures. 4. Tractate Kelim notes that in addition to the treasure listed in the composition itself, there exist additional treasures and another scroll, which nobody knows where it was concealed. In the concluding section of the Copper Scroll, we read that an additional copy of the list, with greater detail than the Copper Scroll itself, was hidden in a water cistern in Janua. So from this we learn that other texts are claimed to have been written on copper plates and contain similar information as the Dead Sea Scroll. And this is interesting. It seems this scroll belongs to a specific genre, treasure list. And honestly, it could already be its own section in the bookstore. How many books about treasure hunting aren't there already out there? I mean, Dan Brown and James Rowling have made some monumental contribution to this genre, in a sense. The difference might be that the list doesn't contain many secret passages and people running around in catacombs. Well, what's more interesting is that this list fits in a tradition not in Israel, but found in Greece. You see, Greek temples used to have lists of relics and treasures in their belongings written and documented on stone tablets. We will return to this connection in a moment, but before talking about the Greek connection, I want to discuss when the hiding of this gold and silver took place, or when it plausible could have happened. Reading the Tractate Kelim, it becomes pretty clear that the author is talking about the treasure from the first temple, mainly because they mention the ark, menorah, and the priest breastplates. And these relics would not have been mentioned if the text was written during the second temple era. So does the copper scroll mention these items? Well, not really. While these plates do mention sacred vessels, they don't detail the vessel's content. But it's not unlikely that these scrolls are built on an older source and an older tradition. If this list would describe the treasure of the second temple being hidden away, it must have been written after 70 CE. However, there are no signs of anybody being around or visiting the Qumran caves after 68 CE. So we hit a little bit of a snag regarding whether the documents is meant to detail the first or the second temple. While the authors like Safray go into deep detail regarding the content of the copper scroll and compare this to the Tractate Kelim, we don't have any definite evidence of the origin of the treasure. However, there could be another clue to this within the Greek connection I mentioned some mere moments ago, just after these short messages. So let's talk about the Greek connection then. As I alluded to, a genre of treasure list came from Greece and was connected to the temples. What I find interesting in particular is one example brought up by Weitzman in Pausnier's book Description of Greece 420.4. We learned that, quote, "For the Messenians possessed a secret thing. If it were destroyed, Messene would be overwhelmed and lost forever. But if it were kept, the oracles of Lycus, the son of Pandion, said that after lapse of time, the Messenians would recover their country." The Messenians were a region and the people in southwest Peloponnese in ancient Greece, and this region was invaded by the Spartans during the classical period when the Messenians were forced into exile. While we never get to learn what this secret that the author talk about, there are quite an exciting connection further ahead in this section, when the future leader, Epiteles, rediscovered the secret thing hidden away in the past by his ancestors. And in passage 4:26-8, we are told, quote, "He took it at once to Epaminondas, told him the dream, and bade him remove the lid and see what was within. Epaminondas, after sacrifice and prayer to the vision that had appeared, opened the urn, and having opened it, found some tinfoil, very thin, rolled like a book. On it were inscribed the mysteries of the great goddesses, and it was the pledge deposited by Aristomenes." In this case, it was written on tin, but again, we see this idea that the important secrets were written on something durable, so as not to be lost to time. Even if this still puts the claim about the Copper Scroll within the realm of being in between fiction and reality, it's still an interesting connection. Add to this the bronze plate found listing temple treasure of a Demotic temple in the Roman area of ancient Egypt. It is clear that these metallic documents were not uncommon in Greek and Roman time, but they are written not only on metal but also on stone. One such example is a document found in a museum in Denmark, the Lydian Temple Chronicles, a 2.5 meter or 8 feet tall stone from the island of Rhodes dating to 99 BCE. As Weitzman points out, the narrative of the Lydian Chronicle is quite similar to the Second Maccabees. In addition to the story, this large stone slab contains an extensive list of temple inventory, and this is not strange itself for ancient Greek. We have treasure inventory lists going back to 400 BCE, especially from Athens, carefully describing what the treasury contained at one point or another. At one point, a logistical issue started to become apparent, and the temple had started collecting too many offerings and needed to, well, devise an organized way to keep track of all these relics and gold and silver hoards. And the solution, it seems, might have been to use their Greek alphabet that they already had as letter labels to keep track of this new inventory system. As I hope you remember, the copper scrolls had Greek letters on them, which potentially had a similar function within this. And according to Weitzman, this way of using the Greek alphabet would explain its function and its presence on the copper scrolls. Another thing in the Lydian Chronicle that might help us understand the copper scroll is that the items don't have to be present to be accounted for. Let's read a section from the Lydian stone. Quote, "Since the temple of Athena Lydia is both most ancient and most honored, and has been adorned with many beautiful offerings from the oldest of times, on account of the epiphany of the goddess, and since it happens that most of the offerings, together with their inscriptions, have been destroyed by time with good fortune, be it resolved by the counselors and the Lydians." See how the author of the records notes that the temple is old and that something has been destroyed or lost simply by time passing. Further down in the record, we also learn how it was damaged by a temple fire. But even if it's still not there, the temple custodian still felt the need for the items to be accounted for. As Weitzman points out, it was crucial during the time of ancient Greek and the culture that this was written within for the people to be able to hold their officials accountable, something that would have been equally important within the Jewish society. And if we read the Old Testament, we have several instances where the main character of the text proceed to take inventory of temple treasures or offerings presented to the Judean God. The inventory list from Greece were displayed publicly within the temples, and a good case could be made that the copper plates was also initially placed in a more visible place. This way, the temple could disclose their offerings while at the same time give an impression that everything was accounted for and in order. It was probably not that anyone or everybody appearing at the temples would be able to see the warehouse with gold and silver themselves. But if suspicion arose, they could point toward the stone and show that they had everything and that everything was listed. And if something was missing, they also knew where it went and what had happened to it. Even if the copper scroll or the tractat Kelim isn't referring to a vault, it still gives the impression that its custodian knew where everything was, how much they had, and it was down to most minuscule fraction of silver or gold or bronze or copper they list in these documents. Weitzman and others point out that the treasure is that way meant to be in a state between both mythology and reality. Something Weitzman explained is also seen in the Greco-Roman world. Quote, many temple treasures in the Greco-Roman period exist in an intermediate state, believed to be real but not available for inspection, not always where they were supposed to be or intact, sometimes more fictive than existent, as it were the case with many treasures listed in the Lindian Chronicle. At certain moment, when the community felt it necessary to audit the temple inventory, the distinction might be clarified to the satisfaction of the community. But for much of a temple's history, the community would not have been in a position to directly confirm which item were actually in the temple and which were not, trusting that they were, but not knowing for certain until the next audit. So while the ancient alien crowd wants to claim this is part of some metallic space library, maybe belonging to the golden library invented by Father Crespi in Argentina,
it seems to be an oddball artifact, and it's written in metal. And you have now the stories of other ancient books, supposedly written in sheets of gold. Joseph Smith Jr., who began the Mormon Church, he claimed also to have been shown gold-plated books. So we have to wonder if possibly all of these metallic books written in copper or gold plates aren't part of some extraterrestrial library.
The real story of the scroll is far more intriguing mystery. It was designed to be both elusive and give an impression of accountability at the same time. Author like Safra may suggest that this is a document written by a sect as a testament to the future and rebuilding of an ideal temple. The first temple reborn instead of the false second temple. On the other hand, author like Joanne Taylor suggests it was written to preserve the temple called in times of occupation. Weitzman might be summarized it best by claiming, quote, "It has been my argument that this was the purpose of the Copper Scroll as well, to confirm that a treasure that appeared to be missing was really there, absent, but accounted for by those entrusted with its safekeeping." Until next time, please spread the word by leaving a positive review on platforms like iTunes, Spotify, or among your friends, family. Share an episode or two with them. Select your favorite episode. Take the pyramid episodes. Everybody loves pyramids. Share them. Get them interested. That's how we grow this, endeavor the best way. And if you head over to diggingupancientaliens.com, you find an extensive list of all the sources and resources and reading recommendations. If you want to learn more about the Copper Scrolls or the Golden Hat or anything in between. If you want to support the show, head over to patreon.com/diggingupancientaliens. Or if you prefer, you can sign up at the membership portal instead. And you find that over at diggingupancientaliens.com/support. Both these options will give you ad-free episode a little bit earlier most of the times and additional bonus episodes. Or you can support the APN network in general by going to archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. If you want to contact me, it can be done through most social media sites or by sending an email to frederick@diggingupancientaliens.com. Sandra Martellor created the intro music and her outro is by the band called Trallskruv, who sings their song Tin Foil Hat. Links to both of these artists can be found within the show notes. Until next time, keep shoveling that science. Men jag skyddar mig för
Sverige har foliehatt.